people think, well, they've wasted a whole lot of time on all these games that are never going to get anywhere. But the reality is that your game design career is less about designing games as it is about designing a designer, which is you. So I haven't been wasting all my time on all those failed projects. They had to happen. I've been building a game designer, and I think at some point in the future, maybe not yet, everything I design will be successful.
Daniel, how did you get into board games, first playing it, and then how did you get into game design?
Well, I think I always grew up playing board games, and it was only really maybe around 2000 that people started playing probably Settlers of Catan, and I already knew I liked some board games, so it didn't take much for me to be inducted into a friend's board game group, and then I sort of bought board games. And then I started making my own board games eventually. That was maybe 10 years ago. I think it's a sort of a standard path where someone introduces you to a board game and you like it. And then you just get into the hobby the same way everyone else does. And I think you'll be pleased to know that I have been spreading the disease of board games to plenty of others, unsuspecting members of society. And I say, come along to my place. We're just getting together for an afternoon. And they say, oh, what will be happening? And I say, oh, nothing in particular, you know, just come along, you know, and then they're doomed.
Yeah. How did you start game design? You said about 10 years ago you got into game design. What was your first prototype? What was the theme of that? Is it something that you finished or shelved? Tell me about that.
It was a game about farming, and I like the idea of making a game with no rules. I don't think I've talked about this before, but it was a game with, you just took a card and the card had an action on it. It was almost like sort of action selection. And because I loved Agricola, I wanted to make like a simple version, but where you just took cards and you could get various resources and build a little farm. And it was good. And I feel like I always plan to go back to it someday because that was my first game, and now I'm working on my 36th game. in my sort of back catalogue of all the projects I've done, I do have a fondness for this one. But like many other games, it was good but not great. And if I went back and redid it, it would have to have a whole lot of work done on it that's possibly better spent elsewhere.
Yeah.
That's sort of my overall big picture approach to my, I have an index file, a spreadsheet with all the games I've designed. Some of them, well, one of them is published, and many of them didn't survive past one revision. Plenty of them had too much work put into them, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's as you go through all these phases when you become a board game designer, the painful abandonment of projects right to now where I just expect to abandon projects.
Yeah. I think going in with that mindset of being okay with killing your darlings as they call it, is super helpful, because I've had that issue and I've talked about it before on the podcast of a game that we spent, me and another co-designer, we spent months on, and like I think we were doing like 4-hour sessions 3 times a week for about 9 months, and then that game, we didn't, you know, get it to a place where we were happy enough to even pitch. And it feels, you know, it can feel bad, but I think you should, like, being okay with that is pretty helpful. And at the same time, I don't think it's ever wasted time, because you do learn a lot in that way, I think.
Yes, I agree. The biggest mistakes are not the games that you spend ages on and get out there, or the games where you play them once or twice and throw them away. It's the games where you put in, you know, 50 revisions into them, trying to get them to work when you should have actually thrown them away much earlier.
Yeah.
In all my successful, all the successful games I've made, they were really good early on. And the biggest mistakes were ones where they were so full of good ideas and I really wanted to make them, but they had fundamental problems that I thought I could just fix later.
Yeah.
And I didn't, and I wasted a lot of time.
Yeah. One thing that you mentioned really quickly, I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. You said that your first game, you wanted it to be a game without rules.
There's an interesting thing about constraints. A lot of people start by designing something with constraints. I played the game Flux once, and I didn't really like the game, but I was enamored of the fact that it didn't really have rules, and you played rules. Imagine a game where you can just put it out there, and the first card, you get handed a card, and that card just tells you exactly how to play the game, and the rules sort of expand out from there, with every card being self-explanatory. And the game was so easy. You know, you just get handed this card, and it says start, and you play it, and it tells you what to do and how to play the game. And there's not much on it. But in reality, this was a constraint that the game never needed. It was just something really interesting. I think a lot of people build into constraints. Like, I'm the designer of Radlands, and the constraint I wanted to put on that is that it was a game entirely based within cards, as it was 84 cards at the time. The publisher then added on sort of tokens and mats and stuff like that, but the constraint itself didn't actually need to be there or survive. It just helped make me a better game designer, because a huge problem that beginner designers make is building without constraints. And sometimes physical constraints or other constraints or rules constraints force you to design inside a real economy, which is a good thing for the wrong reason, but it is a very good thing.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so helpful because, you know, if somebody tells you, you know, you can make any movie you want, or, you know, make something about anything, it's so much more difficult. And you need to put on a constraint or some kind of restriction, and it makes the design process much more interesting.
Yes.
As well, because how do I work around this?
Yeah, so that's interesting to start off with constraints, and people do this in creative writing as well. These days, I don't need to use such basic constraints because I have sort of a standard constraint, which is fundamental to my design, to get into sort of more of the weeds of game design, something absolutely fundamental to my game design. And if you are a beginner game designer, this is something that you really need to learn. It's my philosophy, and you can design however you like, but my philosophy is that the depth to complexity ratio is absolutely central to game design. How deep is your game compared to how complex is it? If you have a game with simple rules that can be explained quickly, where someone can get their head around it, then the complexity comes in working out how to win. That is extremely appealing to people. Not only is it easy to play and easy to understand, but it also has a kind of focus where it's a single activity, like chess, for instance. Chess is about one thing. It's about the arrangement of pieces. They could have made it more complex and added on rules and dice and extra player powers. It's not just that you can learn chess in 5 or 10 minutes. It's that it is only about one thing. And this is what this forces you to do, a kind of elegance, making your game as simple as possible, removing everything which is not the absolute core of your game, and constraining your game down to one single interesting activity with the absolute minimum of scaffolding around that. That is how you design a good game. Because if the player likes that central activity of the game, they will love the game. I see these games with a whole board of millions of different activities. You can get points there and you can get cards there. I don't think this is the way to make a really good game. It's very easy to design something that's complex. It's very difficult to design something that's simple. And this is something that absolutely came through in Radlands. Radlands, just the people in the game, they're upright or they're damaged, which means they're turned sideways. There's no dice, there's no complex rules, there's no combat. It's just a whole lot of people essentially turning each other sideways and cards that do that. But yet it's a really, really good game. And I see these people with their Magic the Gathering knockoffs with, you know, 7 different numbers on their card and 5 different types of card written in a big text box and massive amounts of text. That is not the way to make a good game, in my opinion. The way to make a great game, when it is finished, should look childishly simple. Just a big piece of art with a few words, if any at all, and one or two numbers. And it's that is the way, for so many different reasons, to make a great game.
Yeah, fantastic. And one thing to me that I see a lot of people struggle with, and I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts on, is I see a lot of games, a lot of prototypes that have a real problem with pacing. And I feel like a lot of people go, they'll go for a much longer game than needed, or that like outstays its welcome. Do you have anything?
Yes.
Yeah. To add about how do you get good pacing?
So there's different kinds of pacing. How long is the game? The pacing you're talking about, which is how much do things change in the game. And then there's also a kind of momentary pacing, which is, do things stay at the same speed all game, or are there big moments where a whole lot of stuff happens all at once, where something really big happens? As far as pacing goes, the systems, the short answer is that a game should be as short as possible for you to experience the highest things in the game, the biggest things in the game, or have the chance of exploring them. The ideal game is one turn shorter than people want it to be. It's like, if only I had one more turn, I could have done lots of different things. But because I had the number of turns I had to just get to one little end point. And it leaves them wanting more, because the highest things in the game really are the highest things in the game. As far as movement through the game goes, try every move inside a system of your game should take you a significant way through that system. You know, if you are, if there's 10 points is the maximum, you know, say you've got you're a warrior and there's some level of skill you can have, and the maximum is 10. If you spend your turn or your main action getting skill points, you should probably get 3 of them, not 1. There should be different systems, and every move you make should make you significantly more powerful in that regard. And you might say, oh, this is all relative. No, it's not relative, because the game is there and you should be moving a significant way through part of it on your turn. Like if you choose that I want to be stronger as a warrior, you should be significantly stronger. And someone goes, well, I want to build my shrine, then their shrine should get significantly bigger. You try supercharging your game. I did this on one of my prototypes recently. I said, what if you now get twice as much stuff, twice as much money, twice as much advancement? Try this on your game. It's much better to have a game that's half an hour long and is packed with big moves than a game that's 2 hours long, which is incremental. Not only is the half an hour game shorter, which is just better because you can just play the game 4 times, but it's also much punchier. You cannot make a game. It's almost impossible to make a game too short.
For sure. And so much good stuff to unpack there. One though is I have seen the opposite problem as well. I've seen a game with too many combos where the combos stop giving you that dopamine hit because it's like, okay, I'm going to do this to do that. And then you start thinking, oh, did I forget to do something on my turn? Like what? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yes. Whatever the game is, it should also probably ramp up. This is actually a mistake I've made. There, an important part of pacing, there's a whole lot of timing issues around games. A really important one that I've made mistakes with is in making sure a game ends. Some system in your game should move inexorably towards its end. Like chess, for instance, you can just move your pieces around forever. Now, chess is a great game, but games can go on for a very long time. In Scrabble, for instance, though, the tiles run out. So the game is much more predictable in its length. And that is a good thing, not just because really long games are bad, but because predictability of game length is kind of good. Yeah. So it's important that something in your game does that, and that you start in a game. In a way, a game is about the overcoming of obstacles. At the start of your game, you should be poor and weak and vulnerable. And by the end of the game, you should be just almost godlike, able to do almost anything in the game. So powerful that you break the game and then the game should end. That is the kind of pacing and duration that I like in a game.
Yeah, for sure. It's like the hero's journey, right? You start out with nothing, and then you're gaining and gaining and becoming a hero. And I think that's a player fantasy for a lot of people and a lot of games.
A lot of the psychology of games actually mirrors things in real life. In that way, people like to get more powerful. They like to build things. They like to discover things. A game is not real life, but a game can evoke real life. You know, it can evoke, you know, fear or suspense or, you know, humor, all these things that exist in real life. If you just encapsulate a little bit of them in your pieces of cardboard, you will have a very nice game.
Yeah. And also the constant pushing towards the end game that you mentioned, I think that also allows players, that predictability allows players to plan. And I think that's another part that so many players, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why people play games, right? Yes. But I think a lot of players love that planning. They love that predictability in a game. They love that because that's what's missing from life a lot of the time. You don't know what's next, right? I mean, you can kind of predict it, but in a game, you have this sort of more abstract thing that you know for certain, or you can know for certain, this is going to end in round 7, and now it's round 6, and I've got 3 actions, you know, or some whatever.
Mm. Predictability. is a really interesting subject. Some people think, well, there should be no randomness. Everything should be known. Everything should be like a game of chess. For some games, that works. My opinion on this is that things should mostly or generally be known because you do want to be able to plan out into the future. A big mistake that I see in some games is each turn is a little self-contained puzzle. Like nothing survives from one turn to the next. You're just sort of doing, you're optimizing your current turn. Yes, you have a big picture plan, but you're optimizing your current turn and then sort of that all goes away. And the next one sort of starts with the bits that you had left over. So having some knowledge of the future is useful. Like even with decks, even if they're random, you should have some idea of what's in them. And this is where another really good tip for players is your game should probably have a deck of cards in it, and you should probably draw a card from that deck each turn and put it into your hand. And your hand of cards should probably be kept from one turn to the next. It's not by chance that this exists in so many games. There is so much good stuff that this does for your game that it should probably be in there. You know, from the fact that drawing a card is psychologically interesting, to the fact that it feeds in just a little bit of unknown information to your plan to keep you, to make you able to plan, but not plan perfectly for the future. To the fact that the cards are kind of exploration, you know, you're exploring more of the game. And the fact that a hand of cards usually persists from one turn to the next. Tying turns together is so important in game design. And it's a really hard thing to see that's missing from your game unless you understand it. Because originally, I didn't understand it. But having that hand of cards there, and you say, well, I'll do this one this turn and that one next turn, and then I'll do the other one the following turn for so many reasons that maybe I don't even fully understand. Drawing one card per turn and adding it to your hand of cards is a really good thing that probably should be in your game.
Yeah, I love it when I hear something like that, like a very specific thing. Like recently, my friend Adrian Adamescu, one of the designers of Sagrada and many more games, he told me that one of his little rules or something that he likes to check for when he makes a game is how many minutes is the game approximately and how many points do you get? And he said, I think his thing was make sure it's about 1 point per minute that you have at the end. So if you have a, you know, 100-minute game going to 100. It's something I hadn't heard at all, and I don't think I've put that much thought into it. I'm just kind of relaying it. But I love hearing something like that. Like, oh, that's an interesting way to look at it, right?
That's a very interesting one. My sort of own theory on points is that mathematics is bad. There's all kinds of things that are bad in games, all kinds of work. Now, remind me if I forget what your original question was, but Mathematics is bad. All kinds of things are bad. Having to do physical work is bad. Having to remember things is bad. Having to wait is bad. Having to look out for things happening is bad. Having to refer to things is bad. Mathematics is bad. And mathematics is, for most game designers, they're reasonably good at mathematics. When you have numbers in your game, they should be as low as possible. Get all the numbers in your game and halve them. Does your game still work? If it does, then keep reducing them. Something in your game should be worth 1 point. You know, sure, you can have this thing's worth 2 points and that thing's worth 7 points, but the game probably still works if they're 1 and 3 points. So I would have the number of points in a game be the least number possible that allows me granularity, where I can give things the appropriate number of points. There's an issue actually in Radlands where you get 3 water a turn, and there's an issue that 1 is too cheap. 1 water is too cheap for a lot of things, and 2 water is too expensive for a lot of things. If I'd made the game again, I think I would have chosen 4 water per turn, or possibly 5. Keep numbers small.
Yeah, great. Yeah, for sure. Well, how do you handle, now you said, you know, if you could make Radlands again, how do you handle, what is game development to you? I feel like that's something, just from having talked to you for, what was it, about an hour or so, I've gotten the impression that you, I feel like you are great at game development. And what, how do you develop a game? What do you consider game development is for somebody that doesn't know? And yeah, what are your thoughts on development?
There's essentially two parts of the development. One is the initial creation of the idea, and then the rest is development and polishing, which are sort of indistinct. At the start of, to get my ideas, I have no shortage of ideas. I'm inspired by some little part of a game or something, or I play a game and I think, this could have been amazing. I wish it were different. And then I make my own game that is different. Or there's some little mechanical idea I have in my head. Sometimes it's a thematic thing. Sometimes it's a feeling like, I would like to go on an adventure. You know that feeling when you just go off on an adventure and you don't know what's out there and you're exploring things? Can I encapsulate that into a board game? These days, I more start off with mechanics. Something I've learned is that the rewards for novelty are not that high. So if you're trying to come up with something totally new, that's probably not going to be rewarded that much. These days, I'm less creative than I used to be, and I usually start off with mechanics. The mechanics are, and if you're going to, for new designers, if you're going to start off with mechanics, start somewhere, you should probably start with mechanics. It's kind of safe, and you should play it safe. Start with something that you like and do a new twist on it. Don't try to create something entirely new, because your chance of actually coming up with something that works is low. And this is something I found personally. So at the start, I'm really starting off with mechanics. A great way to make a novel game, but play it safe, is to use 2 mechanics. What about, so I was talking about on my website, daniel.games, if you want to have a look at it. How about, there's heaps of word games. There's heaps of auction games. But what about a word game where there's an auction for the letters? There's heaps of physical dexterity games. There's heaps of war games. But what about a war game that has an element of physical dexterity? If you're looking for somewhere to start, take 2 things that are known and work and put them together. Don't try to create something entirely new. So these days, that's more what I do. And when I'm working on a game, if I need, say, this system isn't working, I just borrow something, you know, holus bolus from some other game. This other game, that has a good card row system. I'll just take that. You can do that. There's no problem with taking existing systems from a game. Don't take a whole game or most of a game. But if something works from another game, it's probably not even new to that game. So the start of the process is doing that. And I quickly come up with something and I put it together. Don't waste time making an entire game. Make the first 10 minutes. Of the game, because you will know in the first 10 minutes of playing it whether it's worth continuing with. Usually it isn't. And the longer I go on, the more brutal I am, and the more I expect that my great idea is just going to be 10 minutes of playing with someone and deciding it doesn't work. Make a deck that's got 12 cards in it. Make the corner of the board Don't bother with fancy stuff. Don't bother with proper card names. The card name can just be Big Guy, and the location can just be House. It's not going to matter. Once you've gone through that first phase, just then ask yourself, this game as it is it good enough? Does this game need fundamental changes, or does it just need a whole lot of balancing and reworking and fleshing out? And if that's all it needs, then you should continue with it. If it's still a great idea, but it fundamentally doesn't work, and you're going to have to change the core elements of the game to something else, you are essentially starting a new design. Throw away that design. Don't try it again. You've just failed at it. Go off and do something else. Make another five games. Do other projects. Learn some more, and then come back to it. I've wasted a lot of time trying to do things that have been these great sort of passions. I always wanted to do this, that have wasted a lot of my time trying to do them, but I don't. Ideas are worth nothing. Your precious ideas, just go through them. Just waste them. They're not worth anything. I've got 100 or 1,000 ideas. Don't treat them as precious. They are not. Dig through them to find the ones that will make great games. It's difficult to be this brutal when you're starting out. But after I've been doing this for 10 years. I've got one game published. I've got two others that have been signed for publication. This is where I am now. You know, I'm more of I'm one part game designer, one part businessman. And that is the first stage. This first stage of deciding, do I even want to continue with this game? That's the first step.
Yeah. Could you give some examples of what some of those dream games were for you? Like the games where you're like, this is a great idea. I'm going to waste time on it.
I've tried about 5 times to make my own Agricola.
Mm-hmm.
Like a farming game, you know, where you build your own farm. It's not like Agricola, and I want to do it my own way. I don't want to copy Agricola. I want to do my own thing with some fundamentally different parts. But I really like that building up thing. I just like Agricola, and I wanted to pull it apart and find, I don't want to make Agricola. I want to find what's good about Agricola and do it myself. And I've tried to make about 5 different farming games, and they've all had fundamental problems with them. And I've wasted time doing that. And I've had so many games where you try to go on a journey. There's a game I keep trying to make, and it's the game where it's just an open world and you can explore and do whatever you like. Mm. And there's just a board. And you say, I want to go across that island, across that sea to the island and explore. And as much as I want to make this game, it doesn't work. And there are fundamental problems with having a game where you just have a 2D board and you go and explore. Like the problem where it's just a type of game. I do not suggest people make a game with a 2D board with one agent. There are so many things wrong with it. Like, the fundamental problem is, if the game's about exploration, why is this even a multiplayer game? Mm. A game about exploration is probably just a computer game, just a single-player game. And what stops you going to the same place repeatedly? Are you going to go around marking stuff with tokens? A fundamental problem is, cool, there's that amazing place. It's just 5 turns away. My turn. I move 3 spaces. Your turn. 5 turns later, I've got to the amazing place. When you try to make a game and you try to make it and you repeatedly try to make it or get it to work, there's a good chance there isn't a game in there that you can find. So many of the problems, if you are a beginner game designer, so many of the mistakes you will make, you will not understand at the time. There's nothing you can do other than fall into the pitfall. If your game does not work, go do something different. Do a different game. Do not keep trying the same game.
Yeah, it's like you described the game that I told you we spent 9 months on and didn't get anywhere. We were trying to make a sandbox game where you're kind of going around the map, fighting monsters, discovering different things. And it was largely inspired by Western legends. I think that game does such a good job of sandbox, but I feel like sandbox is such a difficult... A difficult thing to design. Like, go in there, do whatever you want as a player. You still need to have those goals, and I think that's what we figured out, and we started adding those like little goal cards, like, you know, if you do this, yeah, and all sorts of things. We haven't gotten it to a place. I mean, we've shelved it. We may or may not go back to it, but weren't able to get it to a place where we were like, yes, this is what we're going for.
The harder question for you is, should you go back to it?
That's right. That's right. And for now, it's a, I think it's a no from me. But
we'll you see. sound like you have a few years of game design under your belt. If you're a newbie listening to this, it's, you know, there are so many lessons to be learned the hard way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's almost like I can't even tell you the lessons because you have to learn them yourself.
Yeah.
Because people think these lessons don't apply to them, and they really do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it helps. I mean, they say fail fast. So I think that is what really helps you progress, is making that mistake and then trying not to make that mistake, not making that same mistake again and going out and making a different mistake.
Yes.
But I think you do need to make some of those mistakes. Hopefully, like this podcast and us talking, and because I think that helped me a lot in the beginning when I started out. I started out in 2018 with my first attempt at a game, and I remember listening to different designers and being like, okay, it did help me because it was like, okay, it's not just me, you know, struggling to figure out, you know, how this works. Or sometimes I you know, you also get motivated by listening to other people,
yes,
who have gone there. But sometimes you do just need to go there and figure out, okay, why did that not work? How do I, what else can I make that can work? There's definitely a beauty to me. There's a beauty to new designers as well. Like you said, making a game without rules. I find so many people start out with that like unique idea. And it's like, there's an old saying, I'm going to mess it up because I've only heard it somewhere. But you know, that's to somebody who's new to something, there's hundreds and thousands of ways to do something. Whilst when you get that experience, there's like one or two. You're like, okay, I'm not going to do that because I know that's probably going to lead to a dead end. So I'm going to, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a fundamental question, which I think a lot of new designers will be listening to this. There's a fundamental question that people are not honest with themselves about when they're doing game design, which you need to decide early on, which is, are you designing for fun or for success? Because I guarantee you, they are not the same thing. You can design for fun and you will almost certainly not have success. You can design for success, and I think there'll be a lot of fun in there. For me personally, the fun is in achieving something. I don't want to make a game that no one ever plays. I'm not content to sit there working away to make something that no one will ever play. Some people are very content to do that. Some people just want to make a game for their friends or their family or just for their class or whatever, or just to challenge themselves. Designing for fun is absolutely a valid way to design stuff. You will not go from there to publication, but that's, you know, I wish I could just design for fun like that. But I can't. I personally have to have the end goal of having people play it, which means publication. So from my point of view, I decided early on, I'm designing stuff that will get published. And the fun is a result of that. And that's something you need to be clear of, because what I'm saying might sound very business-like and hardcore, but if you're wanting to design for success, you have to be like that, because there's a reality that your numbers may differ, but as I understand it, and I've seen a few different sources, about 1 in 300 games gets published. Now, if you're imagining that's your game is the 1 out of 300, it's almost certainly isn't. Now, I don't know you who is listening to this. It is almost certainly not your game. My first game published was my 17th game. I'm kind of cheating because I make heaps and heaps of games. But your one passion project that's your first game that you've put years into, it is highly, highly unlikely that that's the one that's going to get published. The games that are getting published are people's 20th or 50th designs. It's not a bunch of newbies. So you have to be realistic that you may have to design a lot of games, throw away a lot of games, throw away a lot of work, and throw away a lot of your dreams. Design things that you didn't necessarily want to make. to be successful. And if that's worth it to you, then that's great, because that's worth it to me. But for many people, it won't be worth it. But you have to decide, do you want to be successful or do you want to have fun? And both are very valid.
Yeah, for sure. That leads me to the question, how can somebody practice game design? What's the way, because what I like to do, and I have like hobbies outside of board games and game design, but what I like to do is kind of try something out, and you know, dip my toes and then see, am I going in, you know, full time. With both feet. How can you practice game design?
To practice to see if you like it. Yeah. What I strongly, strongly recommend people start with is a very, very small game. You might think, oh, but my dream is to make an epic kitchen sink game with everything in it. No. Start with a very, very small design. If you are designing an epic kitchen sink game, also maybe at the same time, start a little project. Design something that's doable and achievable within, like, say, 30 revisions. Design something with a very small number of cards, with no board, just maybe a few tokens and some cards. Something along the lines of, say, Coon, for instance, or Love Letter. You can make a very interesting game with 10 tokens and 20 cards and the rules explainable on one card. There's a lot of skill that goes into designing something that small. And that's somewhere I suggest you start. A game that takes 10 minutes to play, or 5 minutes, 1 minute to explain. You might think that that's sort of weak and you can design something much better. But designing a very small game is a very interesting process, and it's also much easier. There's all kinds of efficiency stuff that goes into game design. If you're making a game that's huge, every time you change something, you have to change heaps of stuff. Start with a very, very small game. It is impossible to design a game that is too small.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And that's, for me, my first published game was actually an experiment. The same person that that we made, that we did the 9 month experiment with, or the 9 months of game development on a game that didn't get
published. That's a good name for a game.
Yeah. we actually started out as we gave ourselves 1 month, and we said, let's see if we can work as a team on this and just in 1 month make something that we can make for 1 month. We ended up making a game called 99 Ninja that was funded on Kickstarter a couple of months ago. And this was about 3 years ago when we started it. And we spent 1 month on that game, then we stopped, and then we started on that big epic game that... but we it was interesting because we were like, okay, we know we have this time limit, which we gave ourselves as a deadline. It ended up actually taking more, because once... Ben, the publisher, decided to take it on. We needed to change a lot of it. We realized, you know, there's a lot that we can clean up, and it became a different game. But, you know, having that restriction and having it's a game where it's just one mechanic is where it started out, just polyominoes, and you're drawing polyominoes from a deck with transparent cards. That's the game, and you're trying to, you know, make different shapes is what it was, and so on. But starting small, I think, is the best way. And that was, for me, my first published game. I think it was about my fifth Good. Attempt at a game. But I think the reason it was published was that small core idea. Yeah.
That's something really important. I said it before, but your game should be about one thing, and it cannot be too simple. Also, when you are designing a game, maybe your game is epic in its story or its theme. You know, maybe it's the history of the world. Maybe it's some great battle or some great adventure. Your game does not get better as you put more stuff in it. You have to decide not only what is your game about, but what is it not about. If you're designing a game about farming, it might be about, you know, the animals and the crops and stuff like that. But then imagine you're designing a game about a village in which there is a farm in the village, and that's one of the things you can do. Then you've kind of zoomed out and you say, well, the game's not going to be about the animals and the crops anymore, because I've got the farm and I've got, you know, the blacksmith and all these other things. The game is not about those things. It's about these things. It's a bit like the game Through the Ages. through the ages is very much inspired by the computer game Civilization. It's a game about the history of the world. And the designer clearly decided that he wasn't going to make a board. There is no spatial representation of the world in the game, which exists in the computer game. And this is really strange. But it's genius because that would take up a huge amount of the complexity budget for the game. And the game is really just about numbers of resources and about cards. So when you decide what your game is, decide how much you can remove from it and just make it about a few things. It's not the real thing. It's a representation of the real thing. Yeah. So decide, and it can be painful to have your game not be about certain things or to just be an abstraction of this great story you wanted to tell. But for all kinds of reasons, make it about less things.
Yeah, that's great. And I see that so many times when you said with your movement on the map example, where I'm going to take three turns just moving around. That is one place I see so many prototypes where they've got these huge maps and huge hexes, and you can move. But why should you have to move, spend, I don't know, 20 movements to get from one side of the board to the other? And I think the more you can condense and the more that you can abstract out, and I love those ideas. Like I love, there's a small game called Microbots Duel where they've got, it's a dueling game where you're fighting with little bots, and it's a card game. But what they have is just a track that represents how far you are from each other. So if you move the track to the left, you're further. If you move the track to the right, you're closer to each other, and that determines how much your defense is. And I thought that's great, It's so easy to understand, and we don't need to have a physical representation of anything. We've got a track.
Yes. It's just a huge trap that I've fallen into many times. When people think, I want to tell this story, I want to make a game about this subject, trying to create a physical representation in two dimensions of that thing, where the pieces or the explorer can go and move around, is such a natural thing, but it is so plagued with problems that having a game, I would advise almost everyone to stay away from it. I'm not sure I'll ever do it again. Having a game which has a map where you have a guy and the guy moves around the map. I mean, one of my other games is a city, a gangster game I was working on. It's a city and there's 20 different places you can go. But there is no movement system. You just pick up your guy and put him where you want to go. And it's great. If you try to do that in a two-dimensional map, all it's doing is reducing your choices. And it's hard to see that. And I couldn't see that at first. I was sure we could make a game like this. It was possible. But maybe it really isn't. And it's even having a map at all is something I would suggest new designers shy away from. It takes up a huge amount of your complexity budget, and it's such a natural thing. Can you tell your story without a map that you move around? If you can, you probably should, because any game with a map where you move around is probably too complex for a newbie to be designing.
Yeah, yeah. Abstracting out, I think, in general, whatever you can, it helps so much. It's like if you're watching a movie and the character says, we're gonna do this thing tonight, and then it cuts straight to tonight. You don't have anything in the middle, right? You don't need to see that character's full day before that. And it's nice. It's like the important stuff. You mentioned something and you just ran through it, something called a complexity budget. What is a complexity budget?
So, something they did with Magic the Gathering. Magic the Gathering is a very complex game. It's been around for a long time. But new people are starting to play the game all the time. If you've been playing Magic the whole time, this is no problem, because it's just been drip-fed to you, all these extra types of cards and concepts and keywords. But what they realize is if you come along to Magic and start playing it now, there's just this massive amount of stuff that you have to learn. And it was keeping people away from the game. So some of the things that existed in the game, there's a thing called mana burn. You use your lands to make mana, and you spend your mana to pay for stuff. But if you spend two, If you have too much mana and you can't spend it, it burns you and you lose life. But this rule is so rare and so pointless that they might as well remove it. And they did remove it. And people were like, no, I enfranchised players said, no, it's in, you know, it's central to the game, but it isn't. And this is the thing, a complexity budget means you should, when I design games, I'm not just designing for improved gameplay. I'm designing also for reduced complexity. Things don't just have to be good. They have to be good relative to their complexity. In my gangster game, you could get a tank and you could go driving around and it would have health and you could, you know, fight people with it, but it was too complex and it wasn't worth its complexity. And I removed it. And if it came back, it would have to be a simpler version. Go through your game. This, you don't need to do this at the start, but as time goes by, you should be asking every component, every system in your game to justify its complexity or be removed, because your game is not competing against other games. It's only competing against other games of the same complexity. You can make your game more complex, but it appeals to less people and it has less focus. So as you go along, everything in your game should be dead simple, ideally. And the things that are not, you should just remove them, even if they added positive gameplay experience to your game. Because you can remove something that's complex and adds a little bit to your game, and somewhere else you can use that complexity to add a new resource or a new concept, which really adds a lot to the game. Mm-hmm. By this method, you see some people and the game gets more and more complex and they add more and more stuff. But it's not getting better. It's getting more complex, and that's worse. Whereas when I'm designing something, the complexity budget starts off high, and over time I reduce it and reduce it. And it's like, oh, this card just, you know, there's the machine gun card, you know, where it's got lots of bullets and you can reload it somehow. Later on, it's like the version of the machine gun that just has bullets but can't be reloaded is possibly the better one, because it's maybe a third of the complexity, but two-thirds as good. That's the way I approach everything. Later in development, this is a really strong thing. Stuff in your game should just be dead simple, and it should be pulling a lot of weight. Otherwise, get rid of it. Either spend that complexity budget elsewhere to add something awesome, or just make your game simpler. Both are acceptable.
Yeah, and I find more and more designers I talk to start at some point, myself included, start embracing and just wanting simpler games and simpler experiences. And in fact, on a recent podcast, I'm not sure I agree with this, but the guest said that in their opinion, Dabble is one of the best games out there. Like one of the because Dabble. It's such a Dabble.
Right.
Are you familiar with it?
No, I have not heard of it.
I know that it's got several names in different regions. So it might be that in Australia, use the US version. But basically what Dabble is, it's a circular tin box. And inside you've got these circular cards. And it's a game that it's a children's game mostly. So you put one of those cards on the table. The card has about 20 different objects on it. And you look at your hand of cards if you see a matching object, you say what that object is and you place it on top. And you're trying to get rid of your cards the quickest.
I've heard of this. And you're right that something like that, you might think, well, is that really a better game than some amazing game? But like for what it is, sometimes you just do want to play a really, really simple game. And some people don't ever want to play complex games. Mm. And that sounds like a game that has an extraordinary amount of depth for its microscopic complexity. So that's actually doing a really good job of having a really good depth to complexity ratio.
Yeah, for sure. And I love a good, simple game, but the other thing that I really love is I love a nice twist. Like I love the game The Mind, for instance, because it feels almost like a magic trick. It's like so simple, but at the same time you don't think it would work until you play it, you know.
That's a good point about the final state of a design. When you look unless it's a complex game, which it probably shouldn't be, when someone looks at your game, if it's clear and simple and you've made reasonable icons and you haven't loaded it up with text and complexity, it should be almost self-explanatory. When they look at the game, they should probably mostly be able to guess how it works. It should look childishly simple, and it should look like a when Radlands was first announced, people looked at this because I designed for this real kind of elegance. And people looked at it and said, what's this? I don't see anything here. There's nothing here. What is this? But what they weren't seeing is that those very simple pieces go together to make a very complex and deep game. And that's the way that you should create complexity. The best complexity is not created by having a whole lot of complex components with millions of icons and lines of text. The complexity comes from the interaction of many simple parts. Each card is simple, but they interact in complex ways. So it's easy to understand, and you can make your own interactions. That's how a game should work.
Yeah. Yeah. The one thing I always ask is something that I definitely have trouble with, and that's designing by myself. From what I hear, are most of your games solo designs? Are you the sole designer?
I design everything solo. There's a correct amount of feedback that you want. You absolutely, everyone will tell you this. This is not some piece of advanced advice. But when people playtest your game, their experiences and their feelings are absolutely 100% correct. Their suggestions are rarely correct. What you really want to do when you drill down, you want to ask people how they felt. And I've played people's games where I've said, how did you feel? And they said, oh, I think this might be overpowered in this game. Or what about this? I said, how did you feel? Because you are creating a game which is a psychological experience. And you ask people how you felt. You are like a chef creating food for people. There is no success outside of people saying that was really good food. Doesn't matter what your excuses are or your explanation. There's only one simple thing. You are creating something for people to enjoy, unless you're designing for fun, as I said before, and you just want to challenge yourself. So when you take feedback from people, that's what you want, and you need to ask them for that. So I make all my own decisions, but I do listen to people a lot. And the specific thing I want to hear is negative feedback. It might sound strange. You cannot be egotistical and be a game designer. And in fact, and when you're kind of experienced at it and you've had some successes, it's easy. If someone just jumps in and trashes your game as a new designer, that can be really crushing, and it's probably not helpful. But as an experienced designer, I ask people, what did you dislike? What was boring or frustrating or confusing or made you feel aimless or hopeless? Come on, give me negative feedback, please. And by the end of the design of, say, Radlands, I was interrogating people, saying, come on, can you criticize my game in some way? And they're like, sorry, it's just really, really good. I'm like, after about 10 of those, so get negative feedback from your game designers. It's really important. And tailor your game to them. Do not argue with their personal experience, but their own. But when they give you feedback about what you should do, just listen. Yeah. But you should almost never enact that feedback.
Yeah, I'd say don't argue in general.
Yes, that's very good advice. Yes.
Yeah. That brings me to a point, and you mentioned like the sort of psychological, like how did players feel, not what it actually is, because sometimes as designers, and I've had that problem many times, is like, you know, that's not kind of the way that they're feeling doesn't necessarily correspond to the game. And I'll give you an example with the game we played today. We played Rise of Babel, which is coming to Kickstarter soon in June. But in that game, like I've heard, it's a game where you have three different rounds and you score at the end of each round. And I've heard players say, Okay, well, there's a big difference in scoring in round one. And I know for a fact that the end, at the end of the game, it's quite well balanced. So I know that you can be really ahead in round one. It's going to balance out. But like that's a piece of feedback that I've heard. And I wanted to ask you, do you design for that, for those first time players? Or yes. Design for experienced players who have already played the game? Because I think it's a pretty different thing, right?
It is. It's possibly a mistake we made in Radlands, which was calibrating the balance of the cards for experienced players. And newbies would come along and play the game and say, this card's clearly overpowered. It's like, no, you just haven't played the game enough, which is quite... Maybe we did the right thing, but maybe we didn't. In a first game is super important. People think, oh, well, people will buy my game and then they will just play it 20 or 50 times. No, if they don't like it the first time, then even if they've bought it, they might not play it a second time. And it's so important because many people will play your game once and once only because they played it with a friend. It's the games club. Someone gets out their random game. Number of games I've played once is enormous. They get out their game and they play it. And if the game doesn't fulfill them on the first play, they will never play it again. What you need to do, there's some precise things you need to do other than just making the game generally good and preferably relatively simple. You should have a beginner setup. Almost every game except for the most basic games should have a beginner setup. It's a pre-game choices are obviously ridiculous for beginners. Like, you cannot be making pre-game choices. Which character would you like to be? You can choose any of these three. I have no idea. Yeah. If there are characters, say, give each player the most simple character. Set the board up in a certain way. You can even give people a specific hand of cards. Everything that's variable about your game should be set to the absolute simplest thing so that people have a positive first experience. You shouldn't calibrate the game to that. But that's something you can do on top of every game and something you should do.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. And that's something that it's kind of my own pet peeve, but whenever I see in the setup the word choose or, you know, or if they don't have that pre-play. And I love it when a game can do something like Stonemaier Games where they actually give you that. You know, if this is your first time playing, try doing this, you know. Yes. This is a fun way to play. And because you as a designer, something that I think about is like, are you incentivizing the most fun way to play the game? Because I see a lot of games, it's like, you're giving me an incentive to drag the game, you know. You're giving me incentive to stall and make the game worse for other players. You're giving me an incentive to bully other players in games that have, like, take that or something. And is that really fun? Like, for some people, yeah, that can be fun. But I find you as the designer, I think your job is find what's fun and reward players for doing that. Reward players for playing in the way that... that is most fun.
Yes. You should find the fun bits and make the game about that bit. And also on that subject, sometimes people will do crazy stuff or silly stuff or something gigantic that breaks the game. Allow them to do that. Make the whole game like that. That's not a problem. That's the game. Someone says, oh, I did this crazy thing where I got my flamethrower and I strapped 10 tanks of gas to it and I sprayed the whole board with fire with my flamethrower and I killed all the enemies at once. That's not a problem. That's amazing. Make that the game. If people want to do crazy stuff, it's your job to enable crazy stuff. Your game shouldn't just be this slow-paced, monotonous thing where you're in sort of on rails or you can only do actions that are so big. Make it possible. This is another thing. It's not pace. I call it big moves. The game should not be a whole lot of moves of the same strength. You can have lots of small moves, but you should be able to set up for a very, very big move. Like in Agricola, you can spend your wood to buy some fences. But if you get yourself 10 or 15 wood in one turn, how many fences can you build? And the answer is 10 or 15. That's fun. That's great. As a player, I want to do that stuff. And as the designer, your job is to make it work. This is the stuff you want to have in your game.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I want to ask you about balancing. I'm not sure if I already asked you about balancing, but specifically, specifically about balancing, how do you approach it? Do you approach it with like getting a lot of statistics, you know, doing the math behind it, or do you approach it with kind of guessing and then doing a lot of playtests and getting the feeling of balance there more than the actual math balance?
Yeah, I've made the statistics mistake as well. Have you ever made a spreadsheet of the stuff in your game to try and mathematically balance it?
I've made multiple spreadsheets, but I have the great skill of being lazy, and I've always left that to a co-designer. If I'm working with a co-designer to do the actual balance, I have made spreadsheets, multiple spreadsheets, but not. I always go for feeling. So,
I think many people will have made this mistake, the spreadsheet mistake, of trying to balance stuff mathematically or statistically. It doesn't work. If it's possible, your game's probably too simple. You know, you must start making your spreadsheet and you think, well, what's the value? You know, doing 100 damage to my opponent is twice as good as doing 50 damage. Well, you know, that's twice as good. But 50 damage is probably enough to win. So what's the value of 100 damage? What if I had to save up for that 100 and it took me a long time? Isn't it worse because of that, where I could do 250s in the meantime? All these little things start to seep in. And you're right. The way you deal with balance, people have asked me this question, what is your technology for balancing? No, I just throw stuff in, I guess. And the weak stuff, I just make it stronger, and the strong stuff I make weaker. That's basically the only way you can really do it. And another problem, the bigger question of balance is, and this might be controversial, balance is not important. Mm-hmm. Balance is super easy to do. And people, if you're a new game designer, you might think this is important. It's not important. You just do it right at the end. You go, well, I'll just change a couple of numbers. Balance, your game could be wildly imbalanced. You know, imagine a game where, a two-player game where the one player wins two-thirds of the time because of the rules. You know, the side they're playing wins two-thirds of the time. It's probably still a really good game. So don't get hung up on balance. Balance is not that important, and especially individual balance of individual objects. As long as nothing's useless, my rule is nothing should ever be something you always or never do. Mm-hmm. The cards in Randlands, you can draw them, and you can play them either as their effect, like a person or event, or you can just junk them for their little ability in the corner, which is some free bonus. Some of them you'll usually play, and some of them you'll usually junk. But as long as there's no card in there that you always or never junk, that's good enough. I don't need everything to be balanced. And when you balance stuff, just as a technical thing, make sure that everything in your game has a number on it. Because when you balance things, make the cleanest, simplest version of the thing, and then just tweak the number to balance. Never add text or rules or caveats to balance things, which is why you should have a number. It could be points, it could be strength, it could be anything, because you know that you're not going to make things that are balanced. And to balance them, you just tweak that number. Like in Radlands, you draw six camps at the start of the game, and you choose which three you want to play, and they will guide your, they'll be very important in your game. I knew I wasn't going to be able to balance all of them, so I put a little number on them. It's usually 0, 1, or 2. And once you've chosen your three camps, you add up those numbers from your camps and you draw that number of cards. So if you take the really good camps, your opening hand will start with very few cards. If you choose the weak camps, you'll have maybe 5 or 6 cards in your opening hand. That's really simple, nice balance. Just use a number.
Yeah, that's a really, I find that really, a really, really good advice. And also, it a lot of it, I don't know, my opinion is that it's more about perceived balance than actual balance. Mm-hmm. And I can give a really good example. The game Treasure Island, I remember talking with the designer, Mark Paquin, And he said that an issue he had, because it's kind of a one versus all game. I mean, it's not cooperative. Have you played it? Treasure Island?
No, I have not.
All right. So it's a game where you've got a giant board, which is a map. And in the beginning, one player is going to just draw on their own personal small version of the board a little dot, and that's where the treasure is. And then all other players are going around the map, drawing circles on that map, trying to find where that treasure is. And that one player who's giving, or who knows where the treasure is, he needs to give clues every turn. So he needs to give a clue. He's trying to get players not to find the treasure. They can lie once or twice in the game. So it's that sort of game. But he said, you know, it's a five-player game, and you've got that one player who is giving out the clues and who knows and who's kind of playing against everybody else. He doesn't want them to find the treasure. And he said when he balanced it, at first he was thinking, you know, everybody needs to have like a 20% chance in a five-player game, right? You need to. But what was perceived by players is that the player who knows where the treasure is losing all the time, because they see it kind of almost as a two-player game, because it's one versus four in a way.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So it's like also like finding the balance for your game doesn't always mean 50-50, you know, like chess.
Yeah. And balance is almost not worth talking about, not because it's not important, but because it's so unimportant compared to all the other stuff that it's just like, it's just a false thing that people sort of, they see balance as some big part of game design and all these other technical and logical things, when game design is mostly psychology.
Yes.
And all this logic all put together is simply a way to create a psychological experience, hopefully with simple rules and that's easy to understand. All of that, even the bigger things in that, all of that put together is still only a minor part of game design.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about replayability, because I think that's really important. It's really important for me when a game ends, for me to want to start again. Yes. To want to play again, even if, you know, even if not today, but to want to go back to that game. What are things that designers can do, or what are things that make you want to go back to games? Because there's so many games where during my first play, I realize I'm going to finish this for the players around the table, so that because they might be enjoying it, but then I'm probably going to decline another game of it.
A good game tells you think that, oh, like, I didn't do it right this time, but I know what to do for next time. I want to try again. And replayability is really important if you want to make a quality game. However, replayability is still not as important as how good the game is. Like, some games should just be played 10 or 20 times, and that's it. Like the original Machikoro, it's got stacks of about 12 different cards on the table. And you buy them and they do things and they get you more money and you buy more of the cards on the table. But the game's the same every time. Say, I'll buy some wheat field or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's only really interesting about 5 or 10 times. They made the expansion. And in the expansion, there can be anything on the table. There is no piles. It all comes out of the deck. And it's so different each time. And it ruined the ability to make a plan, in my opinion. And it was a massively inferior game. So in that game, I don't think the game needed replayability, especially if it's a really simple game. And some games have inherent replayability. Games which are games like Carcassonne, which is like a tile laying game. The cities and the roads will turn out differently each time. Chess, they just have Scrabble. They have massive inherent replayability. Do not automatically throw on replayability on top of your game. However, most games, the best way to add replayability is to change the starting conditions somewhat. So in Radlands, you pick the 3 camps out of the 6. If there's some kind of objective or quest or role that you have in the game, give people a different one each time. It's sort of an obvious thing to do, to say you are a different character each game. However, in my opinion, that doesn't add enough replayability. For some games, including a game I'm working on, that is the correct answer because that just matches the theme of the game, having a unique character you are each time. The key is to have multiple variable things. Like in Radlands, there are only 34 camps. If you picked one every game, you'd start to say, well, I've played with that one before. But you pick three of them, and so it's an entirely different combination. So it never really ends because you keep seeing new combinations. So if there's a game and you have like secret objectives or quests or items or anything during the game that's interesting or unique, give people those things at the start of the game and give them more than one of them. And it will make each game totally different.
Mm. Yeah.
More than one. That's the key.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. What about something that I think every game must have in some way? And
box.
A box. No.
A rule book.
Yeah. Box is not necessary. I've seen envelope games. That is a thing. Oh. There's print and play games. You don't usually print the boxes for them.
And corrected.
rules is one that I think you were onto something. I don't think I've seen a rule-less game. But one thing that I think every good game needs is tension. And I think building that tension, just any form of entertainment as well. Like one of my hobbies is I do stand-up comedy, and a big part of that is building up the tension and then letting it go. So making a tense situation and then showing that, oh, that's not actually tense. And that actually gets, usually that's going to get you a laugh.
Oh, interesting. But I prefer to sit down.
Oh, you should start. anyway, so how do you build tension in games? And is it necessary? Do you agree with what I said?
tension is probably a good thing. I compare two games, Agricola and Caverna. So they're both games about farming. They're quite similar, made by the same person. In Agricola, the harvest is coming. And the harvest is you must have food to feed your people, otherwise basically you will lose the game. It's when all your crops grow, so you really have to get them planted before the harvest because the next one's a while away. You have to get breeding pairs of animals. You just want to get all this stuff done in time. And if someone takes your spot, you are in such trouble. And there's great tension in this game. But a lot of people don't like that tension. They're like Caverna, where it's like you get to the harvest and it's like you need food. It's like, oh, you don't have to cook these animals or these crops. I'll just eat them. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Agricola, you have to have the oven so you can cook the animals. And if you don't buy it, you will starve. You have to cook that grain, otherwise it's almost inedible. Whereas it's in Caverna, people much prefer the lack of tension. I feel like tension is good for most games. And you can add tension by having cutoff points in your game. Don't just make it that you have to get the best stuff by the end. Like a scoring phase, a third of the way through and two-thirds of the way through. So people rush to get their stuff done in time. That's a good way of doing it. Also making things dependent on each other. Agricola has a long sequence of things you need to do in order to get any benefit. And you have to get them all done, which Caverna doesn't. Tension, I would generally put a lot of tension in games. The ability for people to be eliminated, that's high tension. Ticket to Ride, where you're building tracks across the map. Someone gets in your way and you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
Make it so that there are crucial things that need to be done, but don't put tension in every game.
Yeah. I think when I say tension, I feel like tension is a really good thing to keep players asking. Am I going to be able to do this? You know, and I think if you're asking a question, you're interested, right?
Yes.
Again, like with the movie example, I don't know why I don't even watch that many movies, but today I'm like, in movies. But with the movie example, I think You know, you always want to be asking what's going to happen next. There always needs to be a question in your head. And I think that's what keeps you interesting. Like, I'm going to watch this because I want to find out what's going to happen next. And I think tension can do that in games. Like, am I going to be able to take that card, buy that card? Am I going to be able to place that there on my when my turn comes?
It's also good for player interaction. Tension is really important. And that's a really good use of player interaction. In a low interaction game, like, and a game with relatively low tension, let's say Wingspan. Wingspan's a really popular game, and actually a game, one of the few games I like. There's not a huge amount of tension in that game, but they added intention and sort of interactivity in a game that's fundamentally probably doesn't have much tension or interactivity, which was a very good move. That the game's divided into rounds after every, say, 5 or 6 or 7 actions. There's a scoring criterion. Who's got the most cards in their hand or who's got the most birds? And you race to play birds so that you can get in time. Having these sort of checkpoints along the way is a good way to add tension into your game. Don't just make it all about the end.
And to move a little bit, I absolutely love, by the way, talking about game design, game development with you. I can see that you've put so much thought into every little detail and aspect. And people can check out your website to see even more of that. But
Daniel.games. It's just Daniel.games, and I talk about all this stuff there.
Yeah.
It's basically an entire course in board game design. Daniel.games. Yeah. You've already forgotten it.
Daniel.games. But you mentioned that you see yourself as a designer and as a businessman, right?
Yes. Yes. Essentially, you can make money and quite decent money by having not just a published game, but a successful published game. I can go into any further detail. But my approach to designing games is that you have to be ruthless, and you can't necessarily design the things you like, and you have to be efficient. Efficiency is massively important. Early on, I was designing things on paper. Now I use Tabletop Simulator. Early on, I was just roping in a friend every few weeks. Now I've recruited the fans from Radlands, and I have more playtesters than I need. I like to get through. When I'm at my peak, I like to get through one revision a day, like changes to the game, and then play test with a person in one day. I like to be efficient where I avoid making content for the game early on. Of course, throwing away lots of games, not wasting my time on them. Early games, I use, instead of art, I use icons because it functions. People can see which cards are which, and it works. I don't make too much stuff. I don't put too much work into graphics. The card is just a simple square of a color, and it's got a number and a bit of text and an icon. Efficiency, also you shouldn't be using like a graphic design program like Photoshop. It's too hard. Even use a word processor. Anything that lets you get your cards and stuff done quicker.
Yeah.
As you work through, as you, your game design career will not just be about learning game design, it will be about improving your efficiency and your attitude. I like to say people think, well, they've wasted a whole lot of time on all these games that are never going to get anywhere. But the reality is that your game design career is less about designing games as it is about designing a designer, which is you. So I haven't been wasting all my time on all those failed projects. They had to happen. I've been building a game designer, and I think at some point in the future, maybe not yet, everything I design will be successful. But I think that might be a long way off. But I'm not really designing games. I'm learning about game design. And I think if I made games in the same areas where I've already made games, I think I probably could succeed. Not because I've made the games, but because I now know what I'm doing. I know a game design is like a forest. And I now know sort of one or two paths through the forest that, you know, I did walk around in circles many times, but now I kind of know what I'm doing in some small part of the game design world.
Yeah, that is so well said. I had never thought of it as designing a designer, but that is great. And you know, your attitude towards it and that attitude of learning, and you do get better. And it's odd. I mean, getting better at anything creative, it feels like, you know, you have like waves of it. Like you do one thing that's really good, and then you set high expectations on yourself for the next thing, and then it's not that good, and then you know, you need to push yourself. But you do get better, and you do start seeing what you like more and what you can do, and you see like little shortcuts and improve your workflow, like you said, and like make it more efficient.
I was going to say, if you want to be successful, you're going to have to go through this process of getting more efficient, getting faster, not wasting time, and making a lot of games.
Yeah, and what I love about, from what I see of your process, and from the outside looking in, and you've only published Radlands, but Radlands is like such a good game, and I've talked to so many world-famous designers that have talked about how they feel bad that they released some of those early games that, you know, they aren't as proud of, and they're like, you know, I wish this wasn't on Board Game Geek, so that, you know, like,
yeah.
And although, like, I've done the same thing. Like the first couple of games that I did, I think for my second and third or fourth game, I did a little like little print and plays, and now I'm like looking back at them, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I want that to be out there. But at the same time, you know, I think it's good. You know, you should also be proud of, you know, that's the designer I was then. But now look, you know, and if you're not cringing at yourself from a couple of years ago, that means that you haven't made enough progress, right?
So. That's right. You know, you look back at I look back at my game design career, and I look at all the mistakes I made, and the ideas of how easy it would be to be successful. And, you know, the idea that I had was, well, I'm smart and I understand games. I'll make this game and it will get published. It's like, no, that's not how it works. And, you know, there's so much you have to learn. And one really important thing that I sort of haven't talked about is that second part of game design, which is polishing and development. You know, throughout my games, often I do 20 revisions. Like a revision, I make the game or change the game, and then I play test it with someone. And then that's one revision. After 20 revisions, like, hey, this is good. I might get this published. And the publisher, you know, screws me around, or they're slow, or they take ages to say no, and I keep working on it. And after revision 50, it's like, oh, I'm glad they didn't publish it, because it's way better now. Mm. And it just keeps going on. And it's easy to be forced. This is what happened with one of my projects. I was forced by people wasting my time to make the game better and better and better and just keep working on it. And I did keep working on it. And what I learned through that is that there's no such thing as too polished. The game I'm working on now, so Radlands went through 127 revisions, and I should have done more. By the time you think your game is finished, so if you think you've made a game, you should then do that many revisions again. So if you end at revision 40, you should say your game is not done, and you should do another 40 revisions. And at that point, that's basically when you say, my game is done, but I should spend another 80 revisions playing it, just looking out for things that might be improved, even though there's nothing wrong with it and it's great. Now you might think, well, this is an extraordinary amount of stuff. No, if you do that, at the end of those 160 revisions, you will look back and you'll think, I'm glad I did those revisions, because the game is so much better. Because there's something fundamental about success in board games, as it is in books and as it is in anything. When people buy games, they buy the top 100 games or the top 10 games. So as your game, it makes absolutely no difference whether your game is the 20,000th best game in the world or the best 10,000th game, the 10,000th best. You're going to sell almost no copies. But Radlands on Board Game Geek is up to 175. That is where you start to get successful. If you think of it this way, if you make a 6 out of 10 game, you might sell 1,000 copies. Make a 7 out of 10 game, 10,000 copies. An 8 out of 10 game, 100,000 copies. This is how it works. Success is not evenly distributed. Sales are not evenly distributed. It's focused on a very small number of highly successful things. So when you get your game, you think, should I really spend another 80 revisions turning my 7.5 out of 10 game into an 8 out of 10 game? The answer is yes, because it will sell 3 times as many copies or 5 times as many copies. Perfecting games like that, that is the way you do it, by putting more and more and more revisions into games. That's what you, if you want to be really successful, you will spend far more time polishing than you will ever designing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's editing, you know, it's getting just the best, making it.
Yes. If your game is a medium light game, let's say on the same complexity as, say, maybe Radlands or Ticket to Ride or something, and you've done less than 75 revisions, then your game isn't done. Mm. You should keep going. And if your game is a medium weight game and you've done less than about 200 revisions, I would strongly advise you to keep going. Now, assuming this is a good game, because those will definitely yield results. And my experience has been that it is correct to put that extraordinary amount of work in. Radlands didn't appear out of nowhere. I put huge amounts of just endless polishing in once it was finished.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, when it comes out, people will say, oh, that's such a simple idea. Like, I could have thought of that, right? The more you polish it, the more people are going to think, oh, yeah, well, that's like crystal clear what that idea is. And why didn't I think of that?
Yes, when people look at it, they should think that you... It would be slightly galling to people to think that you just randomly plucked some idea out of your head and it was randomly lucky. But the reality is that such a game is a condensation of so many things I tried and so much complexity I removed. And it's the nub of that. It's the kernel. I didn't just go out there and come up with an idea one day and put it in a box.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that happens often. Well, actually, we talked about Through the Ages earlier and Vladek Fatil. The legend goes that Codenames had little to no revisions. I think they've changed the actual words used for the cards. So they tried to get cards that have multiple meanings. And they changed the words, but they never changed, you know, the 5x5 grid and the the teams of spies. So the actual rules they didn't change, they changed the words.
That's actually a really interesting point, because that game is so simple and that is a massive success. And I really, really like that game as well. And we play it all the time.
Yeah, I love it. But also, on the other hand, Vladek Fatil, I mean, he's got so many games that he's done before that. And I think a big part of that is him designing a designer that can do that, you know, that can recognize an idea. And
Yes, that's absolutely right. And there's this... If you're designing games that simple, it is extraordinarily hard to come up with something successful that is that simple. So personally, I don't go that simple, because it takes such skill or luck or both to come up with something that simple that's new, because anything that simple is probably already going to have been done. I like to design it medium light. Medium light is like half an hour to play, 10 minutes or 5 minutes to learn, short rules. That's where I like to design a game that comes in a small box, but not a tiny box. Medium light, you know, I'm not sure if you can think of any medium light games. Mm-hmm. Medium light has just enough complexity to design almost anything I want to do. It never increases to medium complexity, because I'm always removing stuff. Medium light. And if you're a newer designer, I would go light, medium light. Like a game that's maybe as complex as, say, like Coup or Love Letter or Codenames. That's where I design, but I don't need to go above medium light. When I need to, when I want to make some magnum opus, then I will. But I've tried a few times, and it's just a whole lot of work. And you might have noticed that, say, Codenames, done by the same designer as Through the Ages, which has been the bigger success? And which one do you think was easier to make? Through the Ages must have taken years. Mm. And Codenames, he came up with it instantly. You do not get any extra points for making a bigger game. As hard as that might be to hear for someone who's making a really complex game, you do not get more points. You do not become more successful.
Yeah.
You should be as simple as possible, which is why medium light is absolutely where I like to design.
Yeah. Well, you could get more ego points. Your ego could inflate a lot, and you could be like, "Look at this giant thing." Yeah, because otherwise, you know, it is. I found that with, you know, with people, if you're like, "I'm a game designer," then you take out a small box, and they're like, "Oh, okay." I guess you know, they're not as impressed as if you take out this giant box with dragons on it. You know,
It's a strange thing on that. It's not quite game design, but I wasn't really interested in sort of the success or kudos or anything or what people think of me, you know. I just like making games. But the strange thing I found is that you have a game that's published and it's in the shops and all these non-game design people are so impressed. If you have something like that, just a small success, your game is in the game shops. That might not be anything of great importance to you. And it's not really anything of great importance to me. But if you get a game published, people will really hold that in high regard. You know, and if you say, "Hey, I made my own game in my basement." But if you say, "No, it's in the shops, it's worldwide, you know, it's in different languages," you might be shocked at how interested people are in that. And it's a great personal achievement. Even if you only ever get one game published ever, it's something that you will always be able to tell people about. And it's a great conversation starter and something really interesting and unique about you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it shows that you ran the entire distance, right?
Absolutely. Took it
from beginning to end. And it might not be you may not have gone through all the iterations you needed to, and you may have made a lot of mistakes and everything, but at the same time, it is out there and you should be proud of it, you know, even if you can look back and think, I should have done something different.
Yes, well, then you can just make your next game. You know, no game, what do they say? Great works of art are never finished, only abandoned.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So you can never get anything perfect. And, you know, once your game is published, you'll think, I wish I'd just changed that one little thing. But, you know, if you get most things right, that's good enough.
Yeah. All right. So the last question I typically ask is, what is the most, the best piece of advice you'd give to somebody starting out? So it could be something that's impacted you the most. You know, something small. It could be anything. I do realize that, like, this whole podcast has been, or this whole episode has been, a bunch of advice, right? And, you know, how to do things properly and what you think is good game design or not. But what would be, like, the one piece of advice?
Well, I've gone over it a bit, but almost if I could see your game design prototype right now, you amateur game designer out there listening to this, I would almost certainly tell you it's too complex. And you would tell me, "No, it's not. No, it is too complex." Even if it isn't too complex, you should still make it simpler. Almost all games are too complex for what they are. What I tell people is, remove about a third of your game outright, and then the remaining two thirds, make it twice as simple. I mean, this is a very broad statement, so I can only tell you what you should try to achieve. I mean, you can do that in various ways, like make one system do two things. You know, if you've got a special shop where you can buy, you know, you can buy armor, and a special system where you can buy bonuses, make them the same system. You know, just put them all in one spot and make that one system, so you don't have to have two sets of rules. If there are things, merge them, get rid of them, simplify them as much as possible. And make your game, make a good way to think about it is, if I asked you to make the children's version of your game, what would you put in it? And that children's game is probably going to be a significantly better game than the one you're actually designing, not just for children, but for adults, because it's your best stuff refined into that game. And if I could add another little bonus point, which is slightly more technical, that's the biggest one is complexity. The second biggest one is turn structure. When I play your game, I do not want my turn to be a list of steps and procedures and phases and upkeep and maintenance. I just want to do the fun, easy stuff. Get rid of all that stuff. I want my turn to be one action. In most games, it's not possible for the turn to be one action, but two actions is fine. And in more complex games, three actions, that's okay, especially if the action is something simple like drawing a card. The turn should be that simple. And if try to limit choice. If you have a turn with steps in it, don't say, here's your income. You can get two gold or two gems. Just give them one gem and one gold. Do not make them make little choices. Get rid of all the work and the steps and the procedures from their turn and make it all either absent or automatic. And their turn should be quick and simple and do the thing they want to do. That's one of the biggest objections. Any kind of maintenance. At the start of your turn, move this up a track. You know, turn over this card, this and that. Get rid of all that stuff. A turn should be three actions at most, and probably two of them should be automatic.
Perfect. That is great advice. Thank you so much for being a guest. And it was just so interesting and so fun for me to hear your thoughts and share about game design, game development, polishing, all of that stuff. I can see you've really done your homework, and just I love it.
Yes, absolutely. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. And if anyone wants to read all my stuff, as before, it's daniel.games. And thanks for the interview.
Yeah, thank you.